Welcome to We Rebel.
Hi.
Before we get into the news, we want to let you know that we have an amazing interview with Josh Silver, who is the founder and director of Represent Us, represent.us, but us. We're very excited to have him on. It's going to be a cool interview. We're going to talk to him about what he's working on with Represent Us and a bunch of other stuff that he's been involved in.
Mm-hmm. He's got an extensive career behind him as well.
A lot of the people we interview, I'm just like, wow, you've done quite a lot.
I feel like they should all know each other.
Some of them do.
I think we should have like a retreat and they all come because I feel like they'd all love each other.
Oh, could you imagine?
That'd be cool.
That'd actually be really cool.
That'd be super epic.
I would love to just like, could you imagine like if we had like Gita talking to like, I don't know, like literally anyone. Like because just because like, yeah, we have so many people that have a wide array. I can't speak right now.
Wide array of skills. Like Gita talking to Lloyd.
Yes. Gita. Oh,
come
my
on.
Gosh. That conversation would be beautiful.
Josh
Lloyd
and Michael
talking to anybody,
talking to
but also Gita talking to anybody.
Lloyd could also just like read me the McDonald's menu and I'd be like, this is fantastic.
I'm bummed I missed that interview. Mm-hmm. All right. You guys want to get into it?
Yeah. Sure.
So government budget. So this is from an NPR article, but Trump signed the 2-year spending pact. President Trump signed a bipartisan budget agreement Friday morning following approval of the bill in Congress shortly before sunrise. The 2-year spending pact will let lawmakers spend $300 billion more than current law allows. This is an NPR article from Susan Davis, Jessica Taylor, Kelly Snell, and Scott Newman. So this law was passed through the Senate with a 71-28 measure. It does a lot of really good things. This is from a Vox article by Tara Golshan. Where she highlights that it includes $80 billion in disaster relief funding. It extends funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program for 10 years. That's CHIP. It puts $6 billion in funding towards opioid and mental health treatment, $5.8 billion towards bipartisan child care and development block grants, $4 billion towards the Veteran Administration to rebuild and improve veterans' hospitals and clinics, $2 billion towards research at the National Institutes of Health, $20 billion towards infrastructure, $4 billion towards college affordability, and $7 billion in funding and a 2-year reauthorization for community health centers. So these are a lot of really good things that are happening. The downside of this is that there was nothing agreed to about DACA, and a couple pods ago, I said that I don't think that Chuck Schumer is this stupid. And I have to take that back. Mm-hmm. I can't believe this, that they didn't do that. A lot of good things happened. I don't know how we're going to pay for it with
well,
the tax
cuts. Well,
we're not. Yeah.
It's just going to increase the
deficit. This is going to be these.
We're just
this spending's
taking out
gonna,
more loans that we don't have.
Right. And it's going to be used to justify cutting Social Security, welfare entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid. I mean, it is going to be, this will be the excuse used to cut all of these things. And then they'll say, well, the Democrats wanted CHIP and now it's insured for 10 years. And in order to pay for that, we're going to have to take away Social Security benefits. Mm-hmm. So it's problematic because, yeah, we have no way to pay for it. And there's no protections for DACA, which is set to expire on March 5th. They completely rolled over. I mean, it's cool that Nancy Pelosi broke a record and spoke for 8 hours. That's mm-hmm. very cool. But the whole thing in the beginning was shutting down the government for DACA. And then Democrats just roll over this time.
And I kind of mentioned this before. And in fact, when we were talking about Chuck Schumer, whether or not this is all part of his plan or whatever, but I was skeptical then. And I'm disheartened right now because there's still so many thousands of people that are like, their lives depend on this. And I really wish it wasn't such a cheap bargaining tactic for them to try to use this. I don't know what's going on, but we really need to protect these dreamers. And in the only country that they know. And it's really sad that once again, we were at the verge of a shutdown. And yet still on the other end of it, there's nothing like a clean Dream Act right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unbelievable. So Paul Ryan has pledged that he won't bring up any immigration bill that doesn't have the majority of his majority's support, which is called the Hastert rule. And from Wikipedia, the Hastert rule, if you want to know, is also known as the majority of the majority rule. It's an informal governing. The rule is an informal governing principle used in the United States Senate by Republican speakers of the House of Representatives since the mid-1990s to maintain their speakerships and limit the power of minority party to bring bills up for a vote on the floor of the House. Under the doctrine, the speaker will not allow a floor vote on a bill unless a majority of the majority party supports the bill. It's the Hastert rule, named after Dennis Hastert, who used to be the Speaker of the House, who is also a convicted pedophile. So it
quite
just
the asterisks on that one.
Keeps going.
I wonder, I know this is like super idealistic, but let's just like play a game for a second. Remember when we interviewed Alana and she was talking about how DACA is a very like small subset of all 11 million. So sure. I wonder if this is a moment, and again, super idealistic, but I wonder if this is a moment for the Democrats to, since they rolled over essentially, to reconsider that it's not DACA we're going to like die on or whatever on the Hill or whatever, and really talk about comprehensive holistic reform.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that, I mean, like in reality, is that going to happen? No.
No.
But
no.
In our ideal world, like in our small, you know, how can we help that ladder up, since we clearly don't have an answer for DACA? But to be honest, we don't have an answer for all 11 million. Mm-hmm. You know, so is this the time in our, you know, breakout sessions with smaller Democratic Party get-togethers in throughout the United States to take that position? I don't know.
I don't know either.
I know it's crazy optimistic and like absurd, but
well, but it brings up a good point, because right now on this issue, and then what we're about to talk to you a little bit, we're noticing the cracks in our democracy, and whether it's in regards to legislation, transparency. There's a lot of issues right now where it does seem like we could use a very big overhaul in how we do things. Because we might as well just get into it. Before we do that, let's talk about just a couple things. If you want to help for DACA, there's unitedwedream.org. You can go to immigrantjustice.org/defendingimmigrantrights. Go to immigrationadvocates.org or go to familiesforfreedom.org. Any one of those websites, you can get some more information, help, donate, do whatever you can, because we really need to get these lives safe and secured back in this
country.
And
I also think, in addition to that, wherever you live, looking into what is your equivalent of the Immigrants Defenders Law Center in Los Angeles? What is your equivalent of the California Women's Law Center? Because those are the people that are doing all 11 million and not just DACA. Not that just DACA is not worth it. Like, right. I'm on board. Let's do it. But let's, on the hyper local level, is there a way for us to start pushing forward that new narrative that our past guest Alana brought up?
So the point I was going to move forward to was that, so we'll talk about Russia for a little bit, because just the other day we heard that Trump won't release the Democratic memo and sends it back to the committee. This is a CNN article by Jeremy Herb. So President Trump, he said he would not release the Democratic rebuttal to the Republican intelligence memo alleging the FBI abuses of its surveillance authority at this time, and has sent it back to the House Intelligence Committee for changes. And in the letter to the committee, the White House counsel Donald McGahn said, although the president is inclined to declassify the February 5th memorandum, because the memorandum contains numerous properly classified and especially sensitive passages, he's unable to do so at this time.
And I can't believe it.
And right. And so here's, because we literally had that exact same argument about the first one, in which there was sensitive information that did not need to be released. And then there were inaccuracies within this information. And so many people were saying that the Republican memo shouldn't have come out. And now Trump is blocking the Democratic memo, which probably, first of all, he says the Republican memo vindicated him, which countless Republican lawyers said, no, it does not.
Yeah.
And so now he's blocking the Democratic response. And so this is what I was saying. There's cracks in our system that this can even happen.
Well, and when Nunes released the memo, we can't stress enough that there was so much information missing from that original memo. First of all, Nunes didn't read the FISA warrants. Second of all, they said that the dossier was the main principle for the investigation, when it's actually a corroborating piece of evidence, which I will say every single podcast from here on out is a corroborating piece of information. So a lot of information was missing from this. Devin Nunes is a fraud. He's an absolute fraud. And he came out too and was saying, you know, we can't release this. There's a lot of sensitive information on it. The DOJ and the FBI have said that releasing the Democratic memo could be problematic. They have come out and said that, but they also said that about Devin Nunes' memo. Mm-hmm. And Devin Nunes was saying, well, the DOJ said that this couldn't be released. It's like, well, they also said it about your memo and you chose to release it. He's just such a weird little wild card.
He started his own website.
He also started his own website. I know. I was like, do we cover that? I don't think we should, because I don't even want to do
it. It's not worth. Yeah. But yeah, he has
a
website.
Spare time if you want to check it out.
If you want to get involved, though, you can go to AndrewJansForCongress.com. That's Andrew JANZ for Congress.com. He is running in Devin Nunes' district, the California 22nd, against him. Go to his website and donate some money. It's an uphill battle, but it'd be really wonderful to take someone like Devin Nunes out of politics.
So, related, In CNN, Sarah Murray reported about how Trump wants to talk to Mueller, despite lawyers' concerns. So the lawyers have aimed to hit the brakes on this potential sit down with Mueller, but Trump remains eager to speak with the special counsel. And honestly, I would love to see it.
Oh, let that fire just
burn.
I'm
like, just bring
please.
It on.
Let it happen.
I'm like, is this the one time I've agreed with Donald Trump? I don't know. But I think it'd be really interesting. But obviously his lawyers are advising.
Isn't it kind of amazing, though, that they think his lawyers are basically saying that he is too stupid to not go under oath?
That's why I'm like, just do
it. That's what they're saying. That's lawyer speak. They're just saying that the president will perjure himself. The president, who has said he has the best memory of any human being that's ever existed, will perjure himself under questioning.
Well, the funny thing is that the counsel hasn't even requested for an interview to happen yet. Like, they're not even, like, yeah, they know it's coming, but like, they haven't actually said, hey, we'd like to sit down with you on this date. But yet Trump, who is supposed to be innocent, is saying, oh, yeah, I'll talk to him. I'll do it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well,
because
he believes
there.
He's innocent. I mean,
that is true. He truly believes he's innocent.
I love, too, that they
but
said,
he's actually very guilty.
Well, yeah, because he's guilty.
I know. Do the sit down. Let's see it.
They said that part of what's fueling the president's willingness to participate in it is his belief that he has experience with lawsuits and testifying under oath. Because
he's been
part
sued.
Of like 4,000 lawsuits, most
and
of which
says,
he loses.
Also, it says from his time in the real estate business, which is funny because that's like a totally different field.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's just
hysterical.
It is.
I just want it to happen.
This was a really big piece of news that kind of got pushed aside, which I was really surprised about. So Cynthia McFadden, William M. Arkin, and Kevin Monahan of NBC News reported that Russians penetrated U.S. voter system. This is what a top U.S. official said. So in the article, they write, the U.S. official in charge of protecting American elections from hacking says the Russians successfully penetrated the voter registration rolls of several U.S. states prior to the 2016 presidential election. In an exclusive interview with NBC News, Jeanette Monfra, the head of cybersecurity at the Department of Homeland Security, said she couldn't talk about classified information publicly, but in 2016, we saw a targeting of 21 states and an exceptionally small number of them were actually successfully penetrated. There is no evidence that any of the registration rolls were altered in any fashion, according to the U.S. officials. A little bit of a tinfoil hat situation here. You don't necessarily need to alter registration rolls, but you can delete people from rolls. And I believe over 200,000 people in Wisconsin reportedly were removed from their rolls. In the New York primaries, a bunch of people were saying in Manhattan that they were removed from rolls. In North Carolina, people said they were removed from voter rolls. And if you look at a lot of these states, I think Florida is on there. Ohio is on there. Pennsylvania is on there. Wisconsin is on there. I mean, these are all states that barely went to Trump, especially Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and flipped the election. I'm just wondering, I feel like we're like a month away from them saying, yeah, people, Democrat votes were removed or altered. I mean, you don't have to necessarily have proof that if you remove people from the roll, I feel like that's a way you can cover your tracks pretty easily. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm not experienced in cybersecurity, but I think it's a little, I don't know, presumptuous to say there's no evidence. What are the Russians going to do? Are they going to successfully penetrate our voter rolls and then they're not going to do anything? Is that the thought pervading Homeland Security right now?
Well, also, like, because they go on to say that they're fully expecting something to happen in our midterm elections in November. So the our government's ready. They're just anticipating this is going to happen. It's like, I don't know anything about cybersecurity, and I'm no computers, but I'm not that smart. I would love to know if we have something in place to help that whole situation, because this is a very important election, and if we already knew there was tampering in 2016, and it's only going to be more amped up this time, 2 years later.
Yeah, and honestly, I agree with you, more amped up, because this is one of those, like, quickly ladder up situations.
And Jay Johnson, who was the former director of the DHS, he wanted to declare election booths as a part of critical infrastructure, because that's something that needs protection. But then, according to this article, some state officials had opposed Johnson's designation of electoral systems as critical infrastructure, viewing it as federal intrusion. If you read, I was watching a couple of videos about this, and if you like really delve into it on the internet, it is shocking the lack of protection that we have. I don't know why we have so many digital voting booths. I think we need paper trails on everything. And then you hear stuff.
But
like,
what's hard about that is that a lot of voter suppression comes from like only having one day to vote or like having a hard time getting to the polls.
I just think that,
and like, yeah, votes getting lost in the mail. And so it's really hard because we're navigating this transition from paper to digital. But what is the backup?
Yeah.
Because a lot of the voter suppression is a result of that system being different in every state. And, you know, like in a magical world, we could all vote via text. Boom. Everyone would be there. But like, how do we back that up?
But we live in a world where Equifax, you know, breached the security of millions of people's information.
And nothing's been done.
And nothing's been done. So it's like, so how do you protect the integrity of a voting system?
Yeah.
You know, to make sure that your election is completely clean.
No, I completely agree. Yeah. I
really
think the bigger...
We should try to find a guest that's like working in the weeds of this because... I mean, like, what do you advocate for as a citizen? Like, I want a paper trail. I don't want a paper trail. Like, I don't even know what to fight for in this situation because I don't know what the answer is. And I'm assuming they obviously don't either, since like we're still in this situation. But there's got to be a step one.
There has to be. I think. Yeah, I do believe it's incredibly problematic that we have. I think the bigger deal is people being removed from voter rolls.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a both and.
I'm just curious what she means by saying that there's been no evidence so far, because what does evidence
mean? If they've been removed, then isn't that evidence?
Is there a lack of evidence?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Rob Porter and John Kelly, this is a very big story this week. So John Kelly allowed a senior staffer to stay without a clearance despite damning evidence of spousal abuse. This is from Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post. So a senior White House official announced Wednesday that he's resigning following allegations by his two ex-wives of physical and emotional abuse. The official, Rob Porter, served as the staff secretary and often controlled the paper flow to President Trump's desk along with his daily schedule. Porter also oversaw the White House's policy implementation process and worked closely with Chief of Staff John F. Kelly to try to instill discipline in the chaotic West Wing. Porter's first wife, Colby Holderness, said in an interview with the DailyMail.com that he was abusive during their marriage, and he alleged that he punched her in the face during a trip to Florence in the early 2000s and provided photos of the publication showing her with a black eye. One of Porter's ex-wives, Jennifer Willoughby, received a temporary emergency protective order in June 2010 after saying he refused to leave her residence in violation of their separation agreement. Even more horrifying is that the FBI was informed of these allegations while conducting a background check.
That's unbelievable.
As a result, Porter lacked a top security clearance. And to top it off, Politico reports that a senior administration official said John Kelly was previously aware of the 2010 protective order, which prevented Porter from getting a full security clearance. So John Kelly is a current chief of staff and has known about this. If this happened in 2010, that's 7 years ago. We're talking almost a decade of the knowledge. Brings him on. Then when the news is announced, John Kelly releases a statement in full support, which is disgusting. Then photos come out. Then he releases another statement saying that, he needs to go, but he's still a great man. Then Trump releases a ridiculous statement saying that people go through bad times in their life. We're wishing him the best for his career. Mm-hmm. What is going on? And then another speechwriter in Trump's staff resigned a couple days ago because of other domestic abuse allegations. This is a man who has sexually assaulted women, Trump, who is, the Access Hollywood tape. Almost 20 women have come forward. Then you have this happening. I mean, this is a White House. I've never seen a more anti-woman White House.
Well, even Kellyanne Conway came out, I think this morning or late last night, and said, she has no reason to believe the accusations of these women. So it's like they're doing everything they can to save face. This is a completely unrelated note, though. So since Trump has taken office, 40 people have either resigned or been fired in Trump's administration. 40.
Wow.
In 1 year.
Unbelievable.
Just over a year. All because of accusations, allegations, actual wrongdoings, or trying to like get rid, take themselves out of the equation. Like it's just, and this is like, these are the people they surround themselves with. Mm-hmm. This is what it is.
And also, that same article goes on to say, spells it out really clearly. There are two overlapping issues here. Mm-hmm. Is that first, he was allowed to stay in his job after all of the abuse information, including photographs, came out. And then second, that he was able to continue in that job and handle like the most highly classified information, even though he didn't have top security. So it's like he filled out the security form and then just for funsies, they were like, no, you can actually, you're fine. Mm-hmm. So it's like, then well, why have security forms at all? Like why even say that he's not fully signed off? Full clearance or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, like that clearly means nothing now since clearly he wasn't and now he has it. So who else is coming in and out of the White House that doesn't have full security clearance?
Right.
Or whatever level you need or blah, blah, blah. But it's like, this is just another example of complete lack of organizational structure.
Yeah.
And then honestly, I mean,
speaking of,
but it doesn't even surprise me that he's keeping someone like that in his office that has beat up his wives.
Yeah.
At this point,
it's so sad. The state terrible. Of the
speaking
office.
Of organizational chaos, FEMA.
We're going to keep talking about Puerto Rico because yeah. nobody else is.
So FEMA contract called for 30 million meals for Puerto Ricans and 50,000 were delivered.
Terrible.
So
which if you're keeping score at home is a vastly different number.
Yeah. The percentage on that is very low.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially we're pulling this information from an article in the New York Times by Patricia Mezzi and Augustine. Ooh, that's a hard
Armendariz,
thank
I think.
Thank you. And so for this enormous task that they needed 30 million meals for, Tiffany Brown, an Atlanta entrepreneur, and I love a good Atlanta entrepreneur, but let's continue, with no experience in large scale disaster relief,
none.
Zero, and at least 5 canceled government contracts in her past,
jeez,
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, was awarded $156 million for the job. And Miss Brown, who's the sole owner of her company, set out to find some help. So she pulled a wedding caterer. Interesting choice.
With a staff of 11.
With a staff of 11, which is one more than the amount of fingers you
a
have on your hands.
A wedding caterer for Puerto Rico.
And the idea, honestly, the idea of getting a caterer is not a terrible idea because caterers cater events for many millions of people. And we need many millions
Throughout a year, but like...
Meals. No, but think about like large scale events, you know?
Yeah, but
so
like,
that's an interesting idea, but not a staff of 11.
Yeah, yeah.
Like get the catering company that is a national fucking
company.
But
I would think that even
and
like...
just fucking go
if
for
If somebody
it.
Was like, we have to run this gala and someone was like, I've got this 11 staff catering company. I'd be like, we need a bigger catering company for a gala.
I don't... Personally, I would have just gone straight to Costco and been like, let's go. Ship all your food down there. You got more food than anybody else.
Anyways, carrying on,
it continues. She reaches out to a nonprofit in Texas and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Needless to say, this has been retracted because only 50,000 were delivered. But the whole, it's another example. Like it was, what was the other contract for Puerto Rico? Oh, the building infrastructure. We talked about it when it first happened. It was like
Montana.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The group in Montana. It's literally, it's like we learned nothing from that experience.
Yeah.
And we did it again with a small entrepreneur, which, okay, a small business, but like these are for hungry people. Like you don't take a risk on hungry people.
And
you just go straight to the place with the most food that can get it there the fastest.
But it seems like they're trying to do the most amount of work with the least amount.
Job.
They want to do the least amount of effort though. They want to put the least amount of money and time into it
but also,
and thinking it'll solve
they
the problem.
They agreed to put $156 million in. But like if you give not that like I'm a big fan of McDonald's, even like a Ralph's Kroger chain.
Yeah.
Give them $156 million, see how much food they can get down there. Probably a lot more than 50,000 meals.
Anywho, we got to...
Chaos.
Sorry, just keep going. If you want to help out, you can go to UnidosPorPuertoRico.com. That's UnidosPorPuertoRico.com. Or you can go to the HispanicFederation.org. Those are two groups that help out with Puerto Rico.
Look at this shit.
Yeah. Trump wants a military parade. But not everyone is in step.
Oh, and I love a good parade, but like, why is this a priority?
Yeah. So Thomas Givens Neff of the New York Times, he wrote that the Pentagon is in planning stages for an event that was last held in Washington in the summer of 1991 after the end of the 41-day Gulf War. It was celebrated with a $12 million victory parade. And this is pretty ridiculous. So some military parades do happen, but they happen usually in response to a war being won or a big celebration. Trump got the idea to have a military parade because he watched, and this is from the article, and by all accounts thoroughly enjoyed a Bastille Day celebration in Paris. Once he returned home, Mr. Trump said he told President Emmanuel Macron of France that he was considering the idea of a similar spectacle in the United States. First of all, the roads in D.C. can't handle the weight of tanks. This will destroy the roads, which he wants to do. And nobody even supports it. Most Republican lawmakers have said no. And this is interesting. This is from armytimes.com. They did a poll at armytimes.com. And they said, we asked you, 89% said no to Trump's military parade. As the Pentagon continues to work on parade options to present to President Donald Trump, an overwhelming number of Military Times readers have weighed in, don't have one. As of Thursday afternoon, more than 51,000 readers had responded. The majority, again, 89% responded, no, it's a waste of money and troops are too busy. This is third world dictator stuff.
It's a completely like thoughtless way to celebrate the troops. Like, the troops are in other countries. They are on bases. Like, are they going to be able to all just fly to D.C. for a parade? No, they're busy. But so, let's honor them in a way that is meaningful for them.
But Trump is doing it. He's not doing it to honor them. He's doing it for himself.
That's what I'm saying.
That's the only reason this is.
Absolutely. It's like, it's coming from a place of, like, the intention behind all of this is literally just to stroke his own ego. Because it's like, if it was truly about the troops, they'd be able to attend.
I agree.
It'd be like a multi-simulcast, blah, 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 blah. Like, insert any other solution here than a parade, because let's just stick to the Macy's Day Parade and be done with it and honor our troops in a way that is extremely meaningful in a completely different way.
Right.
Yeah. Moving on.
Do you guys want to, let's move on to good news.
Great.
Great.
So a court allows the Pennsylvania to redraw GOP-favored district map. This is very big. From the AP News, Mark Scolforo and Mark Sherman wrote this. The Mark and Mark team. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday let a court-ordered redrawing of congressional districts in Pennsylvania proceed, raising Democratic hopes that a revamped map might yield them several more seats this fall. Justice Samuel Alito, who is one of the more conservative judges on the Supreme Court, who handles emergency appeals from Pennsylvania, rejected the request from GOP legislative leaders and voters to put on hold an order from the state Supreme Court intended to produce new congressional districts in the coming 2 weeks. Pennsylvania's congressional delegation has had a 13 to 5 favor for Republicans during the three election cycles since the GOP drawn 2011 map took effect. And experts say that those 13 seats are several more than they would have been produced by a nonpartisan map. Democrats have about 800,000 more registered voters than Republicans and hold all three elected statewide offices. But Republicans enjoy solid majorities in both chambers of legislature. That should also go back to our other conversation about voting purges. I mean, we're talking about, I think Pennsylvania, again, was on that list of states that were penetrated by Russia, of the 21 states, 800,000 more registered Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Like, something doesn't, it seems a little weird. Right?
I mean, I don't want to be too tinfoily. But this is a really big deal, and feel good, because that means a redrawn map, which is more fair, which probably means more Democrats in office. And speaking of Democrat wins, Dems pick up a deep red legislative seat in Missouri.
Missouri, this is the state where the NAACP encourages black people to not live. Was that the directive?
Yeah, or go.
Or go. Or go. Was it good go-to?
First time in their history. They ever did that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is from The Hill by Reed Wilson. They wrote that Democrats won an ex-urban St. Louis seat in the Missouri State House of Representatives on Tuesday, racking up another victory in a district easily carried by President Trump in the 2016 election. It's a significant swing. Trump won that district by a 61% to 33% margin. That's, I believe, 28 points. Revis is the second Democrat this year to win a Republican-held seat in a state legislative race, after Democrat Patty Shachner, who we covered, won a state Senate seat in Wisconsin. In 2017, Democrats won 15 special elections in districts previously held by Republicans, including a U.S. Senate seat once held by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, which Senator Doug Jones, the Democrat, won in December. So there's been a lot of really bad news. This is really good stuff. And what we talk about all the time, and what activists tell listeners all the time, is take every win you can get. Enjoy your mental health in these trying times.
Yeah, it's important to celebrate along the way. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And
James.
Yes, I'm going to tell you about a candidate to get excited about. First of all, a little warning sign here. Guys, there is a Nazi running in Illinois, okay?
Which literal Nazi.
Can
literal
I just
Nazi.
Say that borders Missouri?
Oh, yeah. So,
in case y'all didn't know.
So be careful. He's trying
careful
to run
out there in those flyovers.
It's a literal
states.
Nazi. I just finished watching season 2 of Man in the High Castle.
Ah.
It's a fun show. I mean, it's not a fun show, but it's
yeah,
like
you
good
rephrase
show.
That.
It's a well-done show. Yeah, I don't like it. It's like that show and Handmaid's Tale. I'm always like, the shows are so good, but the subject matter is so...
What? Do you mean the same thing about Game of Thrones with all the incest, or are you excluding Game of Thrones from that
I mean
that
too, yeah. I mean,
got
obviously...
Got a big problem with that show.
They're hard watches, but they're well-done shows.
Yeah.
Handmaid's Tale is a really well-done show.
I know, I haven't seen it.
Oh.
I know, everyone has that reaction. Anyways, Canada to get excited about in the bordering state of Missouri of Illinois.
Yes. So,
James.
It's just the only thing... I just need everyone to be aware of this man, you know.
The Nazi, yeah.
Arthur Jones, like, don't let him get it. He's unfortunately running a pose on the Republican side, and he will likely be the nominee after the March 20th primary. But there are two Democrats running besides the incumbent.
So far.
So far. So Mary Newman. Or, I'm sorry, Marie Newman. Marie Newman. She's got a lot of wonderful issues going on for her. So healthcare for all she supports. She's thinking about big with small businesses. So thinking about the local man and woman trying to build up their family business as well as the working families. So not just the 1%. She's fighting big money in politics, and she's on a job-focused education and protecting rights and true American ideals, accepting refugees, creating welcome environments. Discrimination needs to be eliminated, whether it be race, religion, gender, sexuality. All of that must be fought tirelessly to make sure that we're all treated equally. So if you want to get some more information on her, MarieNewmanForCongress.com. Go in there, get some more information about her.
And so, also, can we just say that she's endorsed by Emily's List. She's endorsed by the Illinois Federation of Teachers. She's endorsed by Vote Pro Choice. She's endorsed by multiple congressmen and women. She's endorsed by Citizen Action Illinois. She's endorsed by Leap Forward, which is gun safety. More congressional people, Reclaim Chicago, National Nurses United. We're hitting a lot of different types of voters.
She's checking all the boxes.
She's checking some boxes. It's exciting.
I think that's where we're going to leave off.
Gloria Steinem endorsed her. Oh, sorry, that was too exciting to not put in there. Let's carry on.
Yeah, she's great.
Now we're done.
Okay, up next we have an interview with Josh Silver, who is the founder and director of Represent Us. We're very excited to have him on the podcast, so stick around. Enjoy your morning commute.
See you in a second. All right, everyone, welcome back to We Rebel. We're very excited today. We have the co-founder and director of Represent Us. Please welcome Josh Silver to the podcast.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Josh. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We're very excited to talk to you about a lot of the cool things that you've done. You've done a lot. So this is we wanted to start off, and we start with a lot of our guests, sort of how they got into political work and activism. So what sparked your initial interest to get involved?
Well, that's a weird story. When I was 26 years old, I was I was traveling in South America, and with a close friend, we were ambushed. He was killed. I was left for dead. And this is actually a true story. And I came home. And I said, gosh, you know, life is short. I want to have meaning in my life. I want to do advocacy of some sort to make the world better. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll go to do a refugee camp or something and be a volunteer. And a really, really smart old woman named Frances Crowe, who's still alive doing activism. She's about 98 years old today. She said, no, you got to stay home and do your work in the United States, because this is the richest country in the world and we have so much influence, good and bad, on the rest of the world. You need to do your work here. And then another mentor said, you know, it's all about money in politics. It's all about our corrupted democratic systems, and pushed me into that. And then I sort of had a light bulb moment that I think many of your listeners have had, which is when you really peel back the layers of the onion on American politics, you realize that there are a couple of structural issues that really are at the heart of every other issue, whether you care about climate change or poverty or education or efficient government or guns or, you know, safety or food safety, that actually these two fundamental structure issues are the ones that will determine the fate of nearly every issue you care about, and democracy and our nation, period. And those two issues are media and people's access to the facts and to credible information with which they can make informed decisions. And the second is our democratic system, sort of the way elections are structured, financed, how we vote. And after Citizens United, I really saw, that was 2010, 8 years ago, I saw this huge opportunity where the American public finally realized that this issue of our democracy and how broken it is and the auctioning of our policies and our politicians had hit a boiling point, and that there was an opportunity to do something really transformative. And that was how I started Represent Us 6 years ago.
Wow. That's amazing. We do talk a lot about the intersectionality of different causes and how it usually leads back to one or two things. And I love that you highlighted that, because that is a huge thing, I think, within activism circles, is everything sort of boils down to, you know, money in politics or how we talk about things in the media or race relations. Like, it's the intersectionality of activism really does boil down to like a lot of foundational arguments.
Well, yeah. And there's so many rational, simple, relatively simple answers to the greatest problems that face our country. And the reason that they're not happening is that the incentives are all wrong. The politicians who represent us at the federal and state, and to a lesser degree at the county and city levels, they are dependent on major donors, and those donors have agendas that generally go against the public interest, and those politicians are routinely selling out and caving to those special interests that have the most money. Sometimes people say, oh, well, it's not quid pro quo as much as you say it is, Josh, but the reality is if it's not quid pro quo, what you also see is you see politicians whose actual views happen to align more closely with, say, a deregulatory view of the world that is favorable to major industry or major special interests, and they run for office and gain support and win. And so you end up having a system of government where there's two major problems. One is the one I just described, sort of auctioning of our politicians and our laws. The second is that the way we vote is completely antiquated and broken. So you cannot, even though 46% of American voters are registered independent, you cannot run as an independent or third-party candidate lest you be dismissed as a spoiler or, you know, and then everyone's stuck picking the lesser of two evils. And so the way that we vote, the way that elections are conducted, which are 200 years old and have not been improved and fixed, is a fundamental cause of the dysfunction that defines American politics in 2018.
And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned this because I'm jumping forward a little bit in your career. But, you know, you were a part of the Citizens Clean Elections Commission. And that was a huge part about making sure that we are getting the right candidates and they're being elected the right way. And so, yeah, the structure, and we also talked about this earlier in our episode about how our voting system, you know, it's being hacked in by Russians and they're admitting that openly. And so we have all these concerns that we're getting the right people in office and that our voices are heard the right way. So can you kind of explain how the Citizens Clean Elections Commission came about and what steps they are taking, and you, for that matter, that you're taking to make sure that we are having a truly democratic process?
Well, so we're referring to, of course, in 1998, I ran an experimental law that passed in the state of Arizona to create full public funding of elections. Mm-hmm. And that included a Clean Elections Commission that runs that system. Mm-hmm. Now, we know for certain that publicly funded elections, a.k.a. small donor systems, that enable a small amount of public money to pay for candidate campaigns rather than having them dependent on special interest money, that is the superior way to fix this problem, because unless you break that dependence of because politicians need money to run campaigns, unless you break their dependence away from special interests and towards the actual, imagine this, the constituents whom they're supposed to represent, you don't really fix the problem. There has been an important shift, though, guys, and that is that over the last decade, there's been increasing consensus that the so-called voucher system, which has been passed for the first time ever in 2016 in Seattle, which, unlike what we did in Arizona and what's been done in New York City and Los Angeles with the so-called matching system, in Seattle, the system simply says to the Seattle voters, you get four vouchers, they're $25 each, and they are they're essentially money that you would otherwise be paying in taxes, but instead you can direct them towards qualified candidates for city council whom you support. And it was passed in 2016, used for the first time last year, and it worked incredibly well. And the top two candidates that went to the runoff for mayor were both using the system, and of course the winner used it. And it was a real breakthrough, because this is a way to create small donor campaigns, public funding, that is simple, it's intuitive, it's more popular with conservatives and moderates, and it's really exciting. And now we're looking to duplicate that effort all across the country.
So, yeah, what is the next step of popularizing that? Because if it happens in a place like Seattle, you know, some people that it could be a detractor might say, oh, that's in a very liberal part of the country, it's in Seattle, like, why will this work here in Alabama or Mississippi? I guess, what are the steps to make that a more popular method?
Well, I mean, it already is inherently more, as I said before, more popular with conservatives and moderates, just because it's simple. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's a voucher, and that's a term used in education that's more popular and familiar to conservatives. But The idea now is we're looking to replicate the Seattle model in other cities across America, and that's part of what's going on. Because what's really exciting is that when you back the lens out and you look at this issue of democracy, how are we going to fix it? It's very clear the only way we fix our democracy is by taking the fight local, by winning at the state, county, city levels. Washington is stuck, and it's going to remain stuck for quite some time. And so what we're seeing is the map is pretty exciting. We're seeing major campaign finance and ethics ballot initiatives moving forward in 2018 this year in North Dakota, in South Dakota, in Alaska, in Missouri, a big ethics law in New Mexico. We're seeing automatic voter registration, which now exists in 10 states, 9 states in the District of Columbia, which ends this whole silly debate over voter ID and same-day voter registration. Just says everybody's registered automatically, period. We're seeing redistricting reform happening, which would end gerrymandering. Ohio, Michigan is likely, as you probably know, Missouri, Utah. So there's been it's really kind of exciting to see this map light up and see these exciting grassroots groups taking this issue into their own hands and passing the stuff at the city and state level.
Yeah, and that's really inspiring too, that people are starting to become aware of that. I wonder then as well, because I think these two issues kind of go hand in hand. So we're talking about getting people out, getting the message to vote, making sure it's done the right way. So now also the information that's being sent to them. You're a big proponent of making sure that net neutrality is accessible and that everyone has equal opportunity to access the information that's out there. So tell us a little bit about Free Press, the organization that you are also a part of.
So, yeah, I founded Free Press with Robert McChesney and John Nichols back in 2002 on media issues. You know, we started with a really important issue, which is blocking the consolidation of media ownership, because the more media ownership consolidates into the hands of a few giants, the less, the more homogenous it is, the less cutting and accountable it is. And then in 2005, 2006, there was this realization that this issue called wonkily called net neutrality would really determine the future of the media, because when you see the media shifting from analog to digital and you get to an environment that we're now really entering in 2018, where everything, TV, radio, phone service, everything is delivered through a digital connection, be it cable or any other means, then you realize that the rules of the road for how digital communications are delivered and what protections you have as a consumer are crucial. And we see this effort by the incumbent phone and cable companies who control the vast majority of internet connections to be able to block and slow whatever they want indiscriminately. And that's what net neutrality is about. So the internet has always been neutral. You've always had to allow the same kind of content to move at the same speed, no matter who's sending it. And that's just changing now, thanks to the Trump administration and Ajit Pai, the head of the Federal Communications Commission. For the first time ever, we now have a non-neutral network. And that's scary, because that's the end of the internet as we know it. That's the tip of the iceberg for the internet turning into cable television, where Comcast and AT&T and Time Warner decide how fast something's going to download, and how fast others will, and to create competitive advantage, and that's scary. So I think this is going to be an epic battle. I don't think it's over. While the FCC eliminated net neutrality rules recently, I think you're going to see Congress come roaring back at some point, because the public pressure is reaching a boiling point.
And I guess to that regard, could you elaborate more on what it is like now working in these circles in the Trump administration? Because, past administrations have had problems and there have been a set of things to fight against. But it seems like with the Trump administration and their continuing sort of disassembling of democracy and the government, that there's a new issue to fight for every day. How do you guys decide to pick and choose which stuff to fight at the time? And how has the atmosphere changed?
For us, we just tune it out because we operate at the state and local level. The net neutrality fight I just described, that's Free Press, the organization I founded, ran for 10 years. I don't anymore, and they're doing really important work. And you should probably have them on the show at some point, because that'd be a great interview. But for us, we're not really affected by the Trump administration, just simply because we need to keep our attention on the cities and states winning automatic voter registration, vote from home, which is a 100% vote from home mail-in ballots, something we're really fond of. Gerrymandering reform, innovative voting reforms like ranked choice voting and approval voting, which end the lesser of two evil and spoiler problem, and the campaign finance and ethics laws I talked about earlier. I think that's how we ultimately win. We win by redrawing the map of America so that sane and accountable democracy policy and media policy, for that matter, becomes the law of the land, and makes it so that the dysfunction that defines American politics today in Washington, that becomes the exception rather than the norm. And then, in all likelihood, like in 1974, in the wake of Watergate, we see a crisis, a scandal that is of significant enough proportions that you see a wave of reform come through Washington, D.C., just as it did in 1974 post-Watergate, when they created expenditure and contribution limits, they created the Federal Elections Commission, major reform in the democracy space. I think we can set the table so that that will happen again.
So now let's talk about Represent Us now. And you started this almost 10 years ago. And now we're looking at 700,000 members. You have about 63 anti-corruption wins, 5,000 active volunteers, 40 active chapters. How have you been able to amass this great group of people that have somehow decided, yes, we need to get involved. Let's get together. Let's tackle some of these issues. Tell us what it was like trying to organize this to make it what it is today.
Well, so yeah, we're 6 years old. I mean, it's been amazing. I think it's partly because of a talented team. It's also like love in life. It's timing. It's timing is a big part of it, and we just nailed it. I think a lot of it has been really exceptional social media work by really focusing on the heart rather than the head, and trying to figure out how do we make this issue of democracy, how do we make people cry? How do we make them laugh? How do we make them angry? Rather than how do we convince them of an argument? And that has been critical. And we've done, as you probably know, we've done some amazing videos and other multimedia that accomplish that, have created virality. We've enlisted celebrity support. We've got Jennifer Lawrence and Adam McKay on our board of directors. We've got J.J. Abrams and Ed Helms and Orlando Bloom and Kerry Washington and many other celebrities actively involved in the campaign. And we also have a winnable strategy. We're not trying to hit for the fences and win something in Washington, D.C. That's impossible. Instead, we're saying, no, we got to win at the state and local level. And we've got to be we got to think big. We got to not just think, oh, we need public funding, although, as I described, it's a crucial policy. We also need gerrymandering reform. We need voting reform. We need innovative ways of voting. We need to really look expansively and create more opportunities for victories. And I think that's what we've done. It's a big reason why we've succeeded so far.
Absolutely. And you talked a little bit about, you were saying some viral campaigns and getting people involved. Can you talk a little bit about the Gil Fulbright and the Honest Gil campaign? Because I think that that's amazing. It just sounds fantastic.
Yeah. He's awesome. So Gil Fulbright is this satirical presidential candidate. He ran for Senate in Kentucky in 2014, and he's just really funny, and he tells it like it is. He rather than beat around the bushes, and like every politician, he's the first honest politician, and he's going to screw you over. Like, he's going to put the interests of his donors above you, but he'll tell you that, like, right to your face, and when he does, it's incredibly funny. And so we ran him in Kentucky for Senate, and then we ran him for president in 2016. And I don't know if he's going to make another appearance, but yeah, he got a lot of things. He was all over Fox News and CBS News and tons of earned media. And another reminder that, you know, you got to use humor in order to sort of get to people and catch their attention. And when you do, you can really catch a wave, which is what Gil did.
Yeah, I think I was just reading about that, and I think it's so funny. And I think that's a great way of getting people, like you said, getting young people involved, because I think sometimes young voters specifically feel disenfranchised, and I think that was something that the Bernie campaign did really well. You know, the continued chance, I believe, of $7 being the, or $27 rather, being the maximum donation. And I love that, because I think that that's how, I mean, that's how everyone says the next level of voting has to go through young people and millennials. So the Gil Fulbright thing, yeah. I can't stress enough how fun I think that is.
yeah, it's great.
So moving on, I guess, what are some initiatives to look forward to in 2018 and 2020? There's a lot of talk right now about election integrity. What are some things you guys are doing to combat that? And what are some initiatives that we can have our listeners really pay attention to and get involved with?
Yeah, so I'd say there's a few. Now, the most kind of intriguing one in some ways is South Dakota, where in 2016, we worked with our allies on the ground in South Dakota and passed the most comprehensive anti-corruption law ever passed via ballot initiative in the United States. It had created a new ethics commission. It had all kinds of campaign finance and ethics reforms in it. It created publicly funded campaigns. It passed in South Dakota, which voted 2-1 for Trump. It's rated the fourth most corrupt state in the country, according to the Center for Public Integrity. Wow. And then about a month after the people of South Dakota approved this and into law, the governor and the South Dakota legislature just outright repealed it. Just like that. And it was mind-numbing. I mean, it's just kind of beyond words that this how brazen it was. And then the people of South Dakota were so angry that they rewrote it, most of it, as a constitutional amendment to the state constitution, which only requires a 50% plus one vote, and went out and gathered tons of signatures and have the South Dakota anti-corruption amendment heading to the ballot this November. And if it passes, well, it does three things. Number one, it passes most of the original law. Number two, it puts into the Constitution that the legislature can no longer just outright repeal. And number three, it does so in a way that can't be touched by the legislature. So amendments can't be amended or repealed. So it appears that the voters in South Dakota will have the last laugh. Now, as I mentioned, there's other really sweeping reforms at the ballot, likely in North Dakota, Alaska. We're seeing a comprehensive ethics, campaign finance, and gerrymandering reform ballot measure in Missouri. Missouri is going to have a really comprehensive ballot measure this year. Super exciting. Gerrymandering, campaign finance, ethics. We're going to see automatic voter registration at the ballot in Nevada. We're going to see national popular vote, which is really exciting. It's an interstate compact. 13 states have joined. A few more states need to join for victory. And then when that happens, whichever presidential candidate gets the most votes wins the election, go figure, because of an interstate compact that you can learn more about at represent.us. But there's just a lot of activity this fall. Michigan, Ohio, Utah, and Missouri doing gerrymandering reform. So your listeners can get involved by going to represent.us. Another thing you can do, which is really cool, brand new, is you can go to unrigsummit.com/map, M-A-P, unrigsummit.com/map. We have a brand new map that we just launched that shows, we're doing it in partnership with a bunch of other groups, it shows all of the different reform efforts happening all across the country in one place, and it's super cool. So you can click on your state, and you can see all of the democracy reforms happening at every level in your state, and how to get involved. And that's probably your best way to join this fight.
And this year's Unrig the System Summit just happened a couple weeks ago, correct?
Last weekend. It was amazing. 1,500 people. It's kind of amazing and sad. 1,500 people was the largest democracy reform gathering ever, since 1787, since the country was founded.
Wow.
And it was amazing because everybody got together, and it was cool for two reasons. I mean, there's a lot of reasons, but two biggies. One is it got everybody together who's working on these disparate parts of the movement, put us all together and said, you know what? We're all part of the same thing. Like, no one of these reforms is going to fix the system. It's going to take a diverse range of reforms to actually win. And number two, it really embraced this idea that this is not a liberal issue. It's not a conservative issue. This is really an American issue. That is that, the opponents of unrigging the system, our opponents, are not defined by whether they're Democrats or Republican. They really are defined by whether they have power or not. So if you're in a red state, we tend to have business and Republicans against you. If you're in a blue state where the Democrats are in power, you tend to have Democrats in some of the unions against you because they want to keep the status quo. That's just how it is. Mm-hmm. And we really recognize that as a group. You can go to unrigsummit.com. You can see the photos and videos, lots of celebrities, lots of really smart people, musicians. It was an amazing show and educational, something worth checking out.
I think that's fantastic. And the website, yeah, we're just checking out now. It looks really cool. So again, our listeners should absolutely head over to unrigsummit.com and get involved with that. Josh, first of all, thank you again for coming on. You're doing some incredible, incredible work. And, you know, it came from a tragic beginning and you've gone on to do amazing things for this country. What are some recommendations you might have to a listener out there who wants to get involved and go down the same sort of activist path that you have?
Well, I think you need to do two things. I think number one, people who are listening, you need to follow your heart. Like, you got to go with an issue that really clicks for you. For me, it's these structural issues. But if it's not the structural issues, and maybe yours is a different one, go for it. Get involved. Dig into it. Get really immersed in it. And then that gets to the second thing, which is when you do that, stick to the thing that checks two boxes that you enjoy doing. So whether it's organizing or doing communications work or doing programming or writing or being an executive and doing fundraising, whatever that is, that's something you enjoy and you're good at. And be honest with yourself about whether you're good at it. You'll know. But figure out the issue that you care about most, what you like doing, that you are also really good at. And if you can combine those three dynamics, you can have a really productive career in making the world a better place, and we certainly need you.
Well, again, that's amazing advice, and thank you so much. And you have made a career of doing amazing things, so we thank you for coming on the podcast and your continued work. We've been interviewing today Josh Silver, who is the founder and director of Represent Us. If you want to get involved, check out represent.us. Also, go to unrigsummit.com/map if you want to see where you can get involved in your state. Or just get involved in general with a wonderful organization. We are We Rebel Podcast. You can email us at werebelpodcast@gmail.com. We are at We Rebel on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Give us a rating, like us, give us a comment.
All of the above.
All of the above. Josh, thank you again so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll see everyone next week.
Bye-bye.
Hey, so are you looking for like an amazing parenting podcast? No, because there's a million of them.
Yeah, and they're dumb and they're boring.
But you know what?
Make you feel
you know what though? Wait, there's a great one that I've heard of. It's called Why Mommy Drinks.
Oh my gosh, that's my podcast.
Yes, I know, and it's mine too.
I'm Betsy Stover.
I'm Amanda Allen. And we are the co-hosts of Why Mommy Drinks.
We each have three kids, and we're each so tired and very out of our minds.
But we find time each week to interview an actor, a musician, a writer, you name it, artists of all kinds, come into our studio and talk to us about those moments that just drove them to drink in parenting.
You're going to listen to our podcast, and you're going to come away saying, hey, I'm doing a pretty great job.
Why Mommy Drinks.